Okay, today is Thursday, February 12th, 2015. This is the first interview with Phil. I'm going to apologize because I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce this. Phil Pelletieri?
Pelletieri, very good.
Pelletieri, okay. And my name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Phil, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Phil Pelletieri, it's P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E-R-I.
Great. So I'm just going to slide this just a touch closer to you. You can speak at the level you just spoke at. I may have to speak up a little bit. All right, so we know from the previous meeting that we had, the non-recorded meeting, that you're born and raised here in Madison. So my first question is, being from here, did you spend any time on campus before you came here as a student?
Not much. So when I was growing up, it was 18-year-old beer. And so I did spend time on State Street and the like. Did go to football games, you know, and get involved with some of those kind of things. But as far as I had a couple friends who had parents that were associated. So one of my friends, his grandfather, in fact, was associated with the veterinary science department. So a couple times I'd get up here, but, you know, overall, okay. Really not that much.
Did you ever, as you were a teenager, try to, I wouldn't say break in, but go to the Mifflin Street block party?
I was down on Mifflin, didn't spend a lot of time down there. I mean, that, of course, was such a big circus-type party. And, you know, we did get involved a little bit. So in my last couple years of high school was when the Vietnam War was going on pretty big time, and things were really quite crazy here. And then, of course, as my freshman and sophomore year, it was also. And so we get some interactions with that and just the goings-on and the helicopters and the state police and all that stuff was you know, definitely... And I would say in high school, we were becoming quite politically aware, so there was, I said, some way of voicing our protests as high school students to come in and pretend we were college students.
Right. So what part of town did you live in?
Lived on the near west side. In fact, we moved into the Hill Farms when I was probably about five. And when we looked out our picture window, I could see cows and chickens, which turned out to be part of the university research facility, which is now Van Hise or Bell Hamilton School and whatnot. So that whole area was just getting developed.
Okay.
And, of course, now it's kind of the near west side, but that was kind of the outskirts of town then.
Do you have any, since this was before your time here on campus, do you have memories of the Sterling Hall bombing?
Yes. In fact, when the bomb went off, I had just come home and was brushing my teeth. And, you know, you heard something and, you know, I've also experienced one or two earthquakes here. And so you really just weren't quite sure what was going on. You knew something strange. And then, of course, the headlines the next morning. So,
again, this was before your time as a college student, but did you make it down here to see... sort of the aftermath of the bomb?
You couldn't help it. I am driving by. And in high school, I drove a garbage truck for my dad. And so, you know, I was getting all around town anyway. In fact, we used to pick up things on campus and like, too. So, yeah. And at the time, the police chief in Madison was a good friend of my dad's, too. So. Hmm.
So did you? Were you privy to like dinner table discussion from?
Well, I didn't. I learned a long time ago not to talk politics, sex, or religion with my dad. So not a lot. And I think they were pretty well aware of where young people were coming from at the time. And he wasn't a person that was really pro-war. But this kind of, you know, this was the game changer, I think, for a lot of us. Mm-hmm.
So then, did you pursue other options as you were looking at colleges other than UW?
Well, I was the first person in our family to go to the university. I had one cousin who was a university grad. I wasn't the most serious student in high school, had an interest in math and science, and so there was some background, but I really didn't buckle down until probably senior year. When I took my ACT and whatnot, my scores were reasonable, although compared to what the students have to have now to get in, I never would have gotten the door. And I had an interest in wildlife biology at the time because I enjoy the outdoors. And so, you know, with the wildlife ecology department here and the like, I figured that would this be a nice place to go. My parents were very interested in having me stay at home. And, you know, I was working the summers driving truck and making more than enough money to cover tuition and the like. You know, tuition was really quite reasonable back then. So it just kind of seemed like an automatic. So I think I might have applied a couple other places, but I was told I pretty much had a pretty good chance of getting in here, and so that was it.
Okay. So where did the interest pre-college in wildlife and wildlife biology come from?
Well, I just, again, enjoyed the outdoors. I seemed to always do pretty well in science-type courses and the like, and although my father didn't hunt. I had uncles and cousins who did, so I got kind of called in that family tradition. But even when I was young, I used to, you know, like to just go out in the woods and try to learn the trees and, you know, to be able to identify plants and the like. I said, I just thought, boy, that would be neat if you could spend your whole life outdoors, mm-hmm. you know, working in the woods and the like. And so that was my declared major as a freshman walking on campus. Although that changed relatively quickly, but mm-hmm. So.
And we'll obviously sort of get to that change fairly soon here. But just to go back to sort of enjoyed the outdoors, enjoyed being outside, was that primarily here in Madison, or would you go out farther and enjoy outdoors?
Wherever I went, I remember when I was young, we traveled to California, and I did collect butterflies for a while when I was younger, and so I brought my butterfly net and collected butterflies in California, which was really neat because you caught a whole bunch of things you'd never see here and the like. Although that interest pretty much waned by the time I was a teenager, but again, I still enjoyed the outdoors and the like. So
declared as a wildlife biology major, and you said that sort of quickly changed.
Well, so one of the things that they offered at the time, it was a very popular major, and they had kind of an introductory course that Bill Hickey taught. Of course, Dr. Hickey was very famous for his work with DDT and other things, which I very much identify. But the bottom line, what he was telling us is that there's something like 3 or 4 times the number of students right now in school than there are total jobs available if everybody passed. And so, you know, not to discourage you too much, but it's going to be pretty tough sledding. And so my first semester, I think I had probably about a 2.8, you know, just trying to get my feet on the ground. But second semester, honestly, things just blossomed, and I think I had a 3.9 or something. And so all of a sudden, I thought potentially I could move into pre-med. I mean, I had some interest in that. And so that's kind of, I switched over to a biochemistry major and then started on that pursuit, thinking again, it was just kind of a preliminary to apply to medical school. And it was interesting because one of the things that at the time, and I still do think had helped me immensely is that freshman year I got involved with transcendental meditation. And among other things, it really helped me to study, to really help me to focus, you know. And it also helped in exams because you came in rather kind of calm and serene rather than, so they said that things were going really very well there, freshman and sophomore year with classes and stuff, and like I said, with hope of getting into medical school, which, you know, that's an interesting major. Now when I've taught and whatnot, your experience both with being in that group of people but also teaching pre-med students is, you know, it's not necessarily something that, that biology people like those kind of students in the class, because most of the time they don't care about the information, they just care about the grades. I mean, it's just in some of the silliness that goes on with you know, stealing books from the libraries and whatnot. As I said, I got to experience a little bit of that, and that was not a pleasant experience. But
so I want to get back to the little follow-up on the transcendental meditation. Do you recall how you found out about
posters? You know, and at that time, as I said, the early 70s, it was interesting because, again, with the way the culture was in the state with 18-year-old beer, I mean, most of us had fake IDs and we were going to bars when we were younger than 18. And so alcohol really didn't have quite the appeal, you know, and most people would do some marijuana, and I would too, but it was interesting that there was an interest in this transcendental meditation because some of the effects of it was very similar to doing drugs, the calming effects and whatnot. But so at that time, I think it cost us about $35 or $40 to get involved, and they would basically teach you how to meditate. It felt a little cultish to me because there was aspects of it at that time where you could go to, you know, further seminars and the like, and some people were extremely involved with it. I didn't need it. I just needed to learn the technique. That's what was the interest to me. And as I said, I found it to be a very, very good way to set me in a good mind frame to study and the like. So.
And have you continued?
I still meditate. Nothing like that. I mean, then we were suggested we meditated 2 to 3 times a day. I still use it at times when things are stressful and the like, and but I don't, I'm not religious about doing it. And you know, and the whole thing with the Maharishi, as I said, I came from a Catholic upbringing, so I was kind of used to kind of regimented types of things, and there were some real similarities there. You kind of read between the lines. What was going on, but it said it's very interesting. And since then, you know, my wife does Tai Chi, I do some Tai Chi, but you know, and I'm aware of other forms of meditation. But it was always very interesting to watch, because even some of the research that went on campus of some of the brain changes involved with right. people who meditate and whatnot, it's really very fascinating.
Yeah, it's a big thing on this campus now.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me that you had that interest in it, you know, back in the mid-70s. So, if you said this, I didn't hear it. Did you stay at home?
Yeah.
Okay.
I lived on at home until my junior year. That's also when I went through my transformation into an entomologist. And what I ended up doing is dropping down to part-time status. I was working and moved on the Near East Side on Williamson Street with a couple friends. I was doing quite a bit of music at the time. And I had done that through high school too, and so both my friends were musicians, and so I kind of enjoyed that. It was great with my dad. His comment to me is, I spent my whole life trying to get out of, you know, getting us onto the nice side of town, and you go move back there, which, you know, was kind of a strange statement. But and really what happened to me is, you know, as I was going along, I'd taken one semester that really was just brutal, you know, quantitative analysis, chemistry, physics, calculus, and whatnot. And even though I still had aspirations to go to medical school, I said, there's got to be more to it than this, you know, until I figure out what I really want to do. And so when I dropped down to part-time status, which at that time I had to get a check with the dean, I had in fact a meeting with the dean here in the Ag School, and he basically asked, you know, why I was considering that, and I explained. And it was very nice. I mean, he was offering potential scholarships and other things, you know, if this was an issue of money and the like, and there really, to me, there was more to it than that. So that semester I ended up taking a course in art history, a course in psychology, and a course in entomology. It was my part-time status, and Dr. Bob Dick was teaching the entomology course, and I just, yeah, he lit the flame. It was interesting because it turns out Dr. Dick was the father of a classmate of mine in grade school. But I, you know, at that time, didn't, if I was aware he was an entomologist, it was no big deal to me. So, you know, to get that. So all of a sudden I changed and decided, you know, this is fine. And, you know, and it would have been interesting because as you kind of watch the competition of getting into medical school, you know, I was starting to have some reservations. Was I really going to be able to pull it off? But I don't think by any means I'd call this a default. As I said, he just kind of lit a passion and spent the rest of my career basically in the department.
So have you reflected upon or thought about what it was about that class that sort of reignited? You know, you mentioned earlier you collected butterflies and you're outdoors.
Well, I could see that. I mean, insects are just fascinating biologically. I mean, it's he was such an amazing instructor. And it's interesting because I have a colleague now, Dan Young, who is in a very similar mode. You know, Dan, I would venture that 2/3 of our undergraduates were students who were in other disciplines that took his course, and all of a sudden he lit the fire. I mean, he has a very similar kind of enthusiastic teaching style. And again, biologically, if you enjoy the natural world, I mean, insects are just absolutely fascinating. There's always something new to pick up on. And so now all of a sudden you're in a group of people that get as excited about insects as you. And as I said, so that worked out very well. And even at the time, I wasn't sure with the undergrad degree where that would go. And then eventually it led to grad school. I don't know if you want to get into that now.
Yeah, or, we'll get into that later. If not now. Well, let's touch a bit more on undergraduate. So you talked about, you know, this class that lit a fire under you and this particular professor, but were there other classes and or other faculty
So probably the most interesting experience, Dr. John Robinson was teaching a course in organic evolution. And Dr. Robinson was very famous. He was involved with some of the first excavations of human ancestors in Africa, worked with the Leakeys, among other things. I think because of health reasons, he couldn't continue to pursue that. At least that's what we were told. Mm-hmm. And so the course, I mean, he was just a dynamic instructor. And, you know, there was 300 of us in the lecture room up in Bascom. But the most fascinating thing to me was the last week or two of the class that kind of got out of the ordinary things that you would teach in organic evolution, the genetics and, you know, population biologies and other things that goes in. And it almost got spiritual when he would talk. You know, and one of the things that he was conveying is his opinion that, you know, we have probably stopped evolving physically as a species, but he believes where the evolution will come is on the mental side. And he was saying that our interest in thoughts and religion and whatnot, spiritually, may be at the same level evolutionary-wise as the first amino acids that were coming together in you know, the primordial soup that we supposedly evolved out. And so, as I said, he just, I loved the class before that, but that just took it to a whole new level. So that was one instructor I really enjoyed. There was a professor, I took a course in comparative vertebrate anatomy, and Dr. Burns from the zoology department taught the course. It was interesting because a couple of TAs, that one TA in particular that I had in that class ended up to become a colleague in entomology, and Dr. Burns was a parasitologist by training and taught a great parasitology course that, again, everybody raved about. But he used to show up in Hawaiian shirts and, you know, as I said, it was a brutal course. You know, comparative vertebrate anatomy is not the easiest subject to walk through. And even though I didn't do very well in the course overall, I think I got a BC or something in it. As I said, I really enjoyed the way he taught. It turned out then, just the way things shook out, rather than taking parasitology from him, I took a course a different human parasitology course from a different instructor. So I still got, but I always wondered because he approached his course more again on the evolutionary scale and how things have kind of went out versus the one I took was more kind of a typical med tech type of, you know, these are the parasites, these are how we identify them, and these are what their life cycles are. Another instructor I found to be, and I was lucky enough to take a couple courses with him, Dr. John Thompson in botany, took plant taxonomy, and John was just a very interesting instructor. He had a very, grew up in France. His father kidnapped him from his biological mother, and so he had all kinds of interesting stories, but he spent a lot of time studying in Alaska and the like. Again, very adventurous person, very warm person. And I had interactions with John then after, you know, I came on staff here for things. In fact, I gave a couple lectures for the Botany Society he was involved with, and had said I always found him to be a delightful man. And so, yeah, another interesting person, especially as a freshman, Dr. Hugh Iltis out of Botany. And at that time in the College of Ag, we had kind of an interesting survey course, maybe the best way to describe it. It was just one lecture a week. I don't think there was any exams. I can't even remember what was graded. But they would bring in different speakers to talk about various different issues. And Dr. Iltis came in and spoke a bit about natural selection and the like, and suggesting that, you know, it was a big theme at the time is overpopulation. And he was throwing out the theories that indeed maybe we should get rid of our hospitals and other things and just let natural selection take its course. And that was just intellectually kind of shattering to hear that. And then, of course, to watch him. And he's a very passionate instructor. But, he definitely caught my attention back then. And it's interesting because as you go through here, and there's so many great minds and great researchers, but I think the things that people overlook at times is there are some people that are just incredible instructors here. As I said, to light the fire, I advice I often give to young people who come on campus is not to get too hung up on what they want their declared majors should be, and to go out and sample some of this, you know. And it's hard now, in particular with tuitions and the like. But that's so much of what the experience is here. And you know, one of my other pet peeves is I think as a society we do kids a disservice by expecting them all to come here from high school, because you often, if you've got young people who have done whatever for a year or two before they come here, you find out they come so much more focused, so much more mature, and you just kind of get out of their way, you know, when they decide what they want to do, versus, you know, the frustration of a lot of young people of being here 3 or 4 years and have no idea what they want to do with their life. And so I was a bit like that. My kids have been like that. I mean, you know, it's an interesting experience, and it won't change, but I would think that would probably help us a little bit.
Well, let's shift then to either cohorts or friends on campus. So when you were undergrad, who were you hanging out with, and were they people because of your academic interests, or were you hanging out with people for other reasons?
Mostly academic. I mean, it was just people you met. You know, and once I declared entomology, you know, many of the people that were of similar age, you know, and that was never a big major. You know, we probably only have 7-8 undergrads at best. And a lot of the courses I was taking, even as an undergrad, were mixed with graduate students. So I got to know the graduate students in the department a bit. Other people were, again, in zoology courses or in the like. In fact, it was interesting. I ended up becoming good friends with a young man, and this dates me from my era, but he grew up in Racine, and his dad worked for Johnson's Wax, and they do a lot of insecticide stuff. And it was the famous commercial when I was a kid where a gentleman would stick his hand into this great big fishbowl full of mosquitoes and whatnot. Well, that was his dad. Now, again, this is before I declared in entomology and the like, and so Steve and I, we did music together too, a bit. On the music side, I had a number of friends in town and the like, and we had this kind of loose group of probably 20 of us. We even came up with a band name called the Near West Side, Up Against the Wall, Ghetto Gang, Blues Band, and Rock Revival. But basically what we would do is you know, get together and play at parties. I'd be honest, eventually it evolved into playing in bars for beers and whatnot when we'd go on vacation. But it was a kind of ever-changing. Whoever showed up played and whatnot, and most of it was just kind of playing for ourselves. And so that was fun. I had a lot of friends spinning off from that. And, of course, growing up here, I still had some high school friends that were around. I'm venturing probably about 15-20% of my class was on campus here in Madison, you know, and so again, you'd still see some of those people.
What instrument did you play?
Guitar, like everybody.
Who were your influences?
Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, big time. Neil Young, a lot of acoustic music back then, a lot of harmonies. Doobie Brothers, you know, they did some good stuff, and so it was fun. And it turned out one of my roommates, basically professionally into his 50s, was still being a very serious musician, really, really quite talented. So
just to clarify for me, so this band, you said there was about 20 folks roughly who were interested, that you sort of, this cohort of music folks,
right?
Were they a combination of local folks and folks you met on campus, or was it mainly folks that you...
I think more local, but again, somebody like this, the gentleman Steve Mace, my friend that was dad was associated with Johnson's Wax, you know, we just kind of met, and we kind of invited him in. That's what we kind of do. Hey, we're doing some music tonight. Why don't you stop by and whatnot? Mm-hmm. And in fact, Steve and my roommate Paul kind of made a duo, and they did quite a bit of music together. And Paul's the one that stayed on with music well into his 50s. In fact, he still does, but not at quite the level he did at that time.
Okay. So I want to talk a bit more, one more thing about undergrad at least, and that's, you know, spaces. By that I mean either, let's start off with spaces where if you needed a place to study or a place to work, where on campus would you do that?
Basically here in Steinbach Library. You know, the one thing that I found to be a very good experience, and honestly at times I would again advise students to consider it, is at the time, you know, entomology is a major in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. And one of the requirements back then, aside from going through the dilemma that all of us did with registration at the time, and that was more than a little bit of fun, as I'm sure other people have told you, but we were required to get a signature, even as a freshman, whatever our next semester course load was to be, by somebody within the department that you declared. And what that did is it put us in contact, you know, and you developed a relationship with at least one person, your advisor in the department, and then you even had to go up to the college and get a signature from the office and whatnot to officially finish your registration. And that helped, I think, ground. As I said, even when you're struggling a little bit to think of what other majors, usually these people, you know, had some idea. Whereas students that I was in class with that were in LNS at the time, things weren't structured the same. I think it was not till your junior year you had to declare a major. And although there was academic advising, it was much more difficult to get into, whereas here, you know, you basically just knock on the door and you know, see when's a good time to meet with somebody. And so, as I said, I found there was this, you know, one of the points is often made here is that Madison's such a big campus and people can get lost, especially if you're a little bit on the timid side and don't ask questions or try to make contacts. This kind of forced you right away to as I said, to kind of get into the life on campus and how things work. And as I said, it I think is a very good system. It really is.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the registration process, because it's so different today than it was back then.
we'd often tease that if you could survive registration, you deserved a degree. And so basically you would look at the timetable of what the classes were. It was up to you to somehow put together a schedule that worked. But then the problem was is that when your magic time became available, you had to walk to each one of the departments and sign in to the sections, the labs, and whatnot. And almost undoubtedly, especially as you started, the unfair part of the process, at least we felt as a freshman, is that seniors got first picking, so they got all the classes they wanted. And you would spend the better part of a day running around campus from one end to the other, trying to pick up classes, and think you've got everything set, and all of a sudden you'd walk into the last one, and the section was closed, the course was closed, and everything fell apart. And so you'd have to basically try to reconstruct. And as I said, it was typically an all-day process. It was a lot of tension involved because you weren't sure what classes you could get. You had to have backup plans. A lot of times you'd have to run back and try to change a section, you know, to get a better time to open some slot up. And as I said, it was quite the process. Now, you know, growing up here, we cheated a little bit. We'd usually have a driver, a designated driver, so they could move you around a little bit because you couldn't. Although at that time, as a student, you could park on campus. It was Lot 62, which is now a lot of it's been built on. It's over where the new hospital is. But at least you could park a car there and take a bus and whatnot, help a little bit. But as I said, that whole process was really, really quite stressful. As you went on, as I said, and you got some seniority, at least it gave you a little bit easier time of registering because, as I said, you basically had first crack at most of the classes and the like. And but it so very envious when everything went computerized and the like.
Thank you for that. So you alluded to this earlier, but let's ask the question directly. So why go to graduate school?
Well, I was probably, you know, I wasn't quite sure what. Now, an undergrad degree in entomology, again, I still was pondering, should I apply to medical school? You know, I basically had most of the coursework done. And really what happened within entomology, one of the requirements was a course called Pro Seminar. It was taught by different people. It was only a 1 or 2 credit course. But basically what it got us involved with is public speaking, but more scientific, you know, presenting papers at scientific conferences. And so, you know, the time frame, it was a 15-minute talk, and you had to be within 10 seconds and whatnot. And, you know, they changed the subject. You had 3 or 4 different talks you had to give, you know, different aspects or different levels of kind of professional talks. And the gentleman that was teaching the course at the time, Dr. Mallory Bush, I think they wanted us to give a talk on why you're an entomologist. And so I did. And immediately after the class, he said, would you be interested in becoming a graduate student? And I'll give you an assistantship, you know, an RA. And so now all of a sudden, you got the chance to go to graduate school. And the RAs at that time gave you really a pretty reasonable living wage. You didn't have to pay tuition out of it. It was non-tax money. And so I thought, wow, I mean, this is great, you know, get the opportunity. So I got my master's with Mallory. As I said, the opportunity opened up at the time. I was engaged. My wife had a job in town, so, you know, it was really appealing staying around and just kind of see where things would shake out after that.
So, I mean, obviously, in some senses, because you stayed on the same campus to do undergrad and grad, there probably wasn't a lot of change. But in general, what sort of change was there between being an undergraduate in entomology and a grad student?
Well, you had a desk, a permanent home, which worked well. Again, I knew most of the people to begin with and some of the professors. And so, you know, you bond pretty quickly to the rest of the graduate students and the like. So you really felt grounded, you know, and you know, get involved with professional societies and all those kinds of things. So he said it was very easy, very comforting, although, you know, as things evolved, I was trying to figure out what to do when I was finishing my master's. And I, you know, professionally, if I wanted to do something, I need to go somewhere else. I mean, that was pretty obvious to me. But there was a job opportunity at Michigan State in doing. So for a semester, I finished up in December, and I wasn't quite sure what was going on. So I honestly did some private contract work because of my dissertation. I'm a pretty reasonable taxonomist, and so I was doing biological impact work, you know, contract-wise, just trying to figure out what was going on, looking for a potential job, and seeing if that would go. Again, with my wife being established in a career, she's an occupational therapist, you were trying to weigh what made more sense. She had a job, you know, if I could find something really good, you know, maybe we'd move, but, you know, let's not worry, we'd get enough of an income. And I remember we had the branch meetings of the Entomological Society of America in Madison that year in March. So again, I'd already finished, and I was still, Dr. Bush allowed me to be on. We were kind of finishing up some things and, you know, trying to get a paper written, and among other things. And so as graduate students, we were basically heavily involved with running projectors and other things at the meetings, as typically goes on. And again, that's often a good opportunity to make contacts and see other job possibilities. But I remember I was kind of disheartened after that meeting, because really there wasn't a whole lot other than this potential job at Michigan State. And I remember taking a cab home, and it was good that I took a cab home, because I had sat down and had maybe one more beer than I needed to, and was wondering if I needed to go back and drive truck. I grew up driving a garbage truck through high school, and honestly, when I was an undergrad, here too in the summers and the like, it was a family business in town. And wondering, well, all else fails, I could drive a garbage truck for a while. And then it turned out that one of the acquaintances, the people on staff, one of the extension people, Chuck Koval, and we didn't get, it's not that typical for even graduate students to have that much interaction with extension people, because even though if you're one of their students, they do, but if not, I say they're on the road most of the time and the like. And there was a position open. They had gotten some federal dollars to do Dutch elm disease education. And so they were interviewing for you know, a short-term position, and I interviewed with Chuck and Dr. Gail Worf from the plant pathology department. They had gotten that money together. And Chuck came back to me about a week later and said, you know, and so he said, we picked somebody else, he said, but I've got some money, he said, for the summer to start an insect diagnostic lab. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I can identify stuff and the like. And so Chuck offered me basically a 3-month appointment, and I spent 36 years at the university.
I want to ask a couple more things about that. And then there's one thing I forgot, and I think that might get us there today. So it sounds like, even though that position was limited term, summer, it sounds like it was a, if we'll use the parlance, sort of a no-brainer at this point to at least give it a try.
Yeah, great experience. I didn't have long commitment, and you know, definitely, you know, as typical, it was a great summer for learning things. I mean, this was a whole different universe for me. Because aside from making identifications, you're making pesticide recommendations and other things, and that's, again, something as a graduate student you don't really get exposed much to. Dealing with mostly clientele off campus. And the idea of the lab Chuck had come up with, there was a similar type of disease lab in the Department of Plant Pathology. And what was going on for the extension people is they were in the field for most of the summer, so it was really very difficult to take care of the day-to-day business that came in, whether they're phone calls or in particular insect specimens. And insect specimens in a mail tube for a week in the summer aren't pretty. And so this was to have somebody kind of grounded here. That was the big part of it. And we kind of felt if we took care of our clientele well enough, maybe there would be enough you know, outcry or demand to keep it going, and that's really the direction it took off on. As I said, I at the time had no idea, and then, you know, things always evolve in one's career and you get other opportunities within it. But as I said, it was, and I very much enjoy Chuck. He was very much a very strong mentor of mine, just a very dynamic person. He had a presence about him, was almost Kennedy-esque is the way I could describe it. When he'd walk in the room, he had a very, very great radio type of voice, you know. But the other thing that was interesting is, aside from being a very good entomologist, he was very well grounded in horticulture and the like. He worked in a lot of the industry's cranberries and apples and the like. And as I said, I did really good work, but he had such a way with people. When you'd be out with Chuck, he'd run into somebody he hadn't seen for 3 or 4 years. Aside from remember the kid's name, he remembered their dog's name. I mean, he just was very personable, and of course, people love that about him and the like. But I used to like his perspective just kind of on things, whether it's political things on campus, you know, between departments and whatnot. As I said, he really had a broad vision of what was going on and a broad understanding, which you don't always expect to see, again, when you're trained in a relatively specific science area of entomology. But he said he could have taught in horticulture or plant pathology or a number of other places with his expertise.
So you were in the lab for 36 years, as you said, but are there memories from that first summer that are different than the rest?
I remember running a lot. I mean, things were busy enough that, you know, you just in the summer, and that's really, you know, when you'd expect the position to be most demanding as far as phone calls and the like. And in particular, a lot of times because people are sending you samples, you're trying to figure out what's going on here. And one of the things it forced you to understand is that you need to be kind of broad-based. And so even after finishing my master's, I did pick up a couple, 3 courses in horticulture and whatnot, because I found I needed to understand more how plants grew, more. I think I'd already taken the plant disease course, but as I said, when people are coming to you and asking, you know, you're at the university, you know something, just say, well, I only do bugs, I can't do that. That doesn't work, you know, so you have to be. So I got to learn a number of the, especially extension faculty in other departments, in horticulture and plant pathology and agronomy and the like. And honestly, those turned out to be people that I would work so often in extension. We work as teams, you know, when we're giving lectures or workshops and the like. And so, as I said, it almost became a second department per se, you know, the people that were in the cooperative extension group, aside from being associated with the Department of Entomology.
Okay. So, couple more things, and these are, and I think we'll be able to wrap up. They're kind of potpourri. They're kind of just.
Sure.
So you got the job, you've mentioned a couple of times, you know, girlfriend, wife. So at this point, I'm guessing this is 77, summer 77, maybe summer 78?
The job started on May 1st, 1978.
Okay, so summer of 78 then, just to kind of ground us in location, if you will. Were you and your wife married by that point?
Yes. Okay. In fact, so one of the interesting aspects of when I was an undergrad, the semester went past the first of the year. We'd get a Christmas break, and then there was a 2-week section afterwards. We'd start, you know, late, often end of September. So with that in mind, we decided to get married on the 20th of December. The legislature, in their wisdom, decided to change the academic calendar on us. And so it turned out that the semester was moved, so all the exams were going to be before Christmas. So it turned out I was in the middle of exams the weekend I was getting married. And that wasn't too bad, except that I had one exam on the Sunday. I'm getting married on a Saturday. And I was taking a course from one in biological control in the department from Harry Koppel. And so right away I told Dr. Koppel I won't be able to take the exam on Sunday, please. You know, I'm getting married, and can I possibly take it early? And Dr. Koppel would tell me, I don't want to think about that right now, come back later. Well, as it kept on going farther and farther, or closer to the end of the semester, I was getting more than a little nervous. And Dr. Koppel still really wasn't quite open to it. And he even told me outright he didn't like to give exams early, you know. So finally, he said, well, what I will do for you is you can come in, we'll do an oral exam on the Friday. Now, I had three other exams that Friday, but I didn't care. And that stinker spent over 2 hours grilling me for the exam. I tell people I was so exhausted that evening when I went to pick up my tux, I couldn't even do my tux, write the check. I had to have somebody else do it for me, which was great because I slept and, you know, got married and everything was fine. But then, you know, again, becoming a member of the department, I knew Harry pretty well then, but even better. And he told me that, you know, all along he was going to let me off. That wasn't the problem. He was just having fun stringing me out. And I thought, wow, that was, that was really something.
So then where did you and your wife reside during this period?
When we got married, we moved on the south side of Madison in an apartment complex. You know, it's interesting where you live as an undergrad or a graduate student. I mean, it was an interesting place. I had a friend that used to come over every weekend because there would always be police cars, ambulances, fire trucks, something else coming on. People were dealing drugs, prostitution. I mean, just lots of things that they sit back. If my kids were in that scenario, I would pull them out immediately. And we just, you know, this is part of the adventure at the time. We kind of tolerated it quite well. It was off campus. It's a little bit of a bother trying to get in. But as I said, at that time, you could park on campus as a student, and eventually we had to pay gate fees and eventually bus fees and whatnot, but at least there was some parking available close enough to make it reasonable, so that's why it worked more than anything else. And
I think my last question for the time, unless a follow-up jumps out at me, is I asked you about places on campus to study, but what about either places on campus or in the community where you would go, you know, hang out, either play a gig or have a beer, or some of the places that you enjoyed doing that at?
Yeah, one of the things, you know, growing up here in 18-year-old beer is, believe it or not, I mean, people used to stand outside for an hour to get in. There was lines at some of the more popular bars. The original KK, the college club, which is where the Memorial Library is now, was a very popular bar. The Pub, another bar farther up State Street, was a very popular bar. The Amber Grid, which is across from, it's on University Avenue, across from the old hospital, was another extremely popular bar. And you sat back, and I mean, nowadays, you would literally, when things were crowded, you couldn't hardly move, and you're drinking cheap Schlitz beer and whatnot, and you would just thought this is the way the world was supposed to work. And a place where we played quite a bit of music was a place called the Brat and Brow, which was on Monroe Street. And they used to have more folksy stuff. They really wouldn't have a lot of rock and roll stuff. And, you know, whether you contracted with them or you had friends that were there and you just stopped by to play a couple songs is kind of the way things worked a lot. And so that was fun. And that's a much more mellow place compared to, as I say, some of these. But then it changed, you know, to full alcohol and the like. And what that did is it dispersed everybody to some degree. I mean, still the college bars, but you didn't see this. I didn't see the lines of people, you know, taking a very long time to get in and the like. So that was interesting to watch. But as I said, the other thing is that we weren't really drinking that much beer at that time, and you'd go in and play foosball at the pub or something like that, you know. You could always run into to people you knew and the like. So you just played a little bit of foosball down at the Memorial Union too. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. As an undergrad and a grad student, was the terrace a place where you would hang out, or was that not so much for you?
Probably more indoors than outdoors, because in the summer, as I said, I was working 60 hours a week, mm-hmm. driving truck and getting up at 4 in the morning, so I, even though I tried to have a social life, I didn't do a very good job of that. But but it was a place to have coffee, you know, play a little bit of pinball. Honestly, probably a couple semesters, my grades weren't quite as good because I'd get involved with a pinball game and decide not to go to class type of thing, which, you know, but so the Rathskeller was, as I said, a place you could kind of always go in and study down there too. I mean, it really was, even though there was a little bit of music in the background, a little bit of commotion, it was a place you could still study.
So maybe one more thing. You alluded to earlier, or you said earlier, that there were a few things that you didn't talk to your father about. But, you know, living at home, being here in Madison, it sounds like you worked for him in the summer.
Yeah.
I wonder if you knew how he felt about this career path of yours.
So one of the jokes I give, and I'm not speaking at times, especially people, the name Pelletier is pretty well known because of the trash business in town. And honestly, my dad wanted me to take the business over. And our relationship was not that good at the time. In fact, I spent time living with my sister. We were estranged enough and the like. And so I teased people. I said, my dad wanted me to become, you know, take the trash business. And I said, Dad, after working for you and seeing all the bugs, there'll always be, because he said the thing about trash is there'll always be trash. There's always going to be work. And I said, after working on the trucks, I know there's always going to be bugs and the like. As things evolved, I said we didn't have as much contact. So once he saw that I was in graduate school and whatnot, and he didn't quite understand that. I mean, he didn't even understand what a requirement for a degree is. I said it was kind of foreign to the family to a degree. But I think he was good with it, as long as you're making money. And you know, and as things evolved in my career, I got so much public interaction and so much press that all of a sudden, you know, because you're doing a newspaper article or you're doing a TV piece and whatnot. So he very much admired it. And I think I didn't think as a younger in high school or whatnot, I don't remember my dad ever showing any pride in anything I did. But I picked that up as an adult that changed. I said, we are very different people. Although one of the things that I laugh about now when he asked me to take the company, I said, I don't think I want to work with people that much, Dad. And then to see where things evolved. Mm-hmm. But
Phil, do you have anything else, you know, about this time period, your early years up through the first job, the summer job that became the full-time job? Anything on your mind you want to talk about?
Well, one thing maybe just, you know, we touched on a little bit, but you know, during the Vietnam War and whatnot, and then even being a student on campus at the time of, you know, walking up Bascom Hill and seeing a line of state police with billy clubs and whatnot, or at the time during the rallies, just the passion involved and just kind of getting caught. I remember at times I would park off campus and walk in, and if there was a scheduled rally or the like, as you're walking to campus a block or two away, there would be these old junk cars, basically, but they were still running. The windows had all been taken out. They were all chicken wire screened, and these were state police, whatnot, just sitting there waiting in case something were to happen so they could respond. And just, again, how intimidating that was. And I think for a lot of people of my era, you know, it almost seems like a dream now. I mean, the point of, as I said, National Guard troops being present and helicopters at night with giant floodlights and, you know, all the craziness and passion. And as I said, it's just so far removed from where we are now around here. That you know, it's something imprinted. And again, I think most of us felt very passionate. My draft number is 115. At the time, it looked like there was a moderate chance that I was going to get drafted, and I'm trying to decide what is my best interest. And this is, again, even just as I'm coming here as a freshman. As it turned out, that particular year, they only got up to 80 for whatever reason. You know, it said that the projections weren't quite right, and so I kind of ducked out of that. And, you know, for the next 3 or 4 years, you were still a little bit nervous, but things were starting to wind down. But also at the time, again, then you had classmates or people who had cousins or whatnot that were killed in the war or other things I said. So it was a very passionate time. And as far as my father was concerned, as I said, I could tell he said it was not something we got much into. He didn't think much of what the students were doing. And it's also interesting is when you traveled around the state at that time, the perception, because again, in my career, I deal a lot lecturing off state and whatnot for a while there, to hear the how people think all of Madison burned down, you know, and, you know, find the grocery store. There was a grocery store on University Avenue that was burned down and during some of that time. And there was also a little bit of a disassociation between us as students and the faculty. And what I came to find out is that when the department was made aware that the Department of Entomology was on a list, and very high on the list, of potential targets. And this was because of pesticide issues, and among other things. And of course, we used to have an ROTC building just over here on the corner, and I remember that and the like. And so there was a couple of the department cars that were trashed, among other things. But the faculty had a very interesting perception. There was a real disconnect between us. You know, they used to talk about sitting up on the 7th and 8th floor of Russell Labs and looking out and seeing all the craziness going on and just wondering where this was all going to go. And then to be on the student side of things and having a whole different perception of what was going on. And so it took some time for those, I don't know if you would say wounds, or for us to get connected. I mean, there was a bit of a disassociation there. But when I started hearing, again, some of where their concerns were coming from and some of where their worries were from, you could understand, you know, why they were really leery of all the happenings. So.
Well, let's wrap this up for the day then. So this concludes the first interview session with Phil Pelletieri. Thank you for your time.
Okay.